I would like to show you some photographs this morning. This is the first one. In fact, it was recognised earlier on. I was quite surprised. I wanted to find a picture of a lake, so I looked through some old photographs and I found this. This is actually a place called Lake Bazumtwi, which is in Ghana, quite close to Kumasi. Now, I was there 30 years ago, and it's a crater lake. It was formed by a meteor hitting the Earth millions of years ago, and this lake is actually miles wide, and there are villages around the shores of the lake. And I can remember coming up the side of the crater with some friends, walking, and coming over the top, and I just stood spellbound. All the rainforest down below, this huge lake spread out below me. It was amazing. A stunning and unexpected sight. And so we walked all the way down to one of the villages, and I'm told that it's now quite a popular tourist spot, so there'll be a lot of people there now, but there weren't many then. And we found some logs by the side of the lake, so we thought, well, we'll push them out into the lake and swim for a bit. And then we suddenly thought, hang on a minute, what's in the lake? So we stopped one of the local men going into the village and said, are there any crocodiles in this lake? And he said, well, I've lived here all my life and there are no crocodiles, absolutely not, definitely no crocodiles. And then as he walked away, he turned his head over his shoulder and said, well, I don't think there are. And I don't know how you would feel, but I felt a little bit nervous about that. And we did, in fact, go into the lake and we discovered there weren't any, thankfully. But all around the edges of the lake, there were reeds. And you wouldn't have to go far from here to discover reeds, would you? You've got, what is it, Broomfield Park next door? And if I remember rightly, there's a lake there. Groveland. Where's Broomfield? Oh, anyway, it doesn't matter. Groveland Park. And there's a lake, isn't there? And I'm sure there'll be reeds there. And I live, not too far away from the River Lee. And there's a disused quarry which is now flooded from the river. It's absolutely packed full of reed beds. It's an international site for seeing all sorts of birds. And so on to our next picture. Well, reeds, you don't really need me to describe them to you, do you? So reeds, they're magnificent things which are built to stand straight, and when the wind blows, they rock with it. And it's a wonderful sight, seeing the wind move across and all the birds and creatures that live within the beds. But, next picture please, sometimes things don't always turn out the way you expect. Now, in the book of Isaiah, the prophet refers to a bruised reed, and we will come back to that. Well, this is a picture of a bruised reed. Like some other plants, the problem is, if it bends, if there's a little bit of damage on the side, the whole thing will collapse. You can't save it. You can't repair it. There's no way of getting it straight again. Some other plants, you can do that. You can do all manner of things to patch them up and to support them, but not with reeds. And so it's a very powerful image to anyone who's familiar with them. And so this morning, we're going to think a little bit about what a bruised reed is. It might seem a rather abstruse concept to you at the moment, but I hope you'll bear with me and go through it with me in a few moments. Now, we're going to sing again, and I understand this is probably a song that you don't know. Now, this is a song, when I was thinking about this subject, I thought, got to have God of Grace. Which is in Songs of Fellowship, not in Seeing of Faith. And this is a Chris Bowater song. And it's the most amazing description, I think, of what grace is all about. And I remember when I used to be part of a church in another part of London a long time ago, every time we played God of Grace, one of the young ladies would come down to the front and she would dance. And she would dance out the song. It was an amazing thing to see. I mean, we used to cry. It was so powerful. because the song meant so much to her personally because of her experience of God's grace. I won't go into detail. And she couldn't stop herself. We're going to have a look at some more photographs. But first, I wanted to direct your attention to that particular verse in Isaiah, because at the beginning of the passage, you may well remember that the prophet says, "Here is my servant whom I uphold, my chosen one in whom I delight." He's talking about the coming of Jesus. "He will not shout or cry out or raise his voice in the streets. A bruised reed he will not break." A bruised reed he will not break. And I want us to think about bruised reeds for a moment. Now, let's find the next photograph. You won't recognise this. There's nothing terribly exciting about it. This is Mablethorpe. If you've never been to Mablethorpe, you haven't missed a lot, let me tell you. And I can remember being taken there by my grandparents with my parents. I think the only one went once, but the day is forever fixed in my memory, and I'll explain why. Because along the front of Mablethorpe, as you can see, there's a long promenade. And it was a hot bank holiday, I think. Crowds of people. Lord knows why they went to Mablethorpe. But anyway, there were crowds of people. And I kept sort of playing around, and I was about four at the time, as young children do. And my mum kept saying, "Don't go too far away, come back here." And I kept skipping off and coming back and so on. Until eventually the inevitable happened. Can I have the next picture, please? That was me at the age of four. What a handsome man. Well, we'll go back to Mablethorpe. We've had enough of that one. Thank you. And before long, I was lost. And the crowds of people going by, and I couldn't see my parents or my grandparents in them, so I stood at the side. I remember there was some sort of wall, and a very kindly lady came up to me and bent down, and she said, "Are you lost?" And of course, being pig-headed as I still am, I said, "No." "Fine, thank you very much," and she went off, but she obviously wasn't convinced. Because a few moments later, she came back with a policeman. Now, in the days, of course, when policemen used to be on their beats, so there was one not so far away. And I can still remember this huge, towering guy with his helmet and everything. And he sort of bent down and said, "Are you lost?" I said, "Yes." So he said, "Okay, don't worry, come with me." And he took me by the hand. And I can remember the shame I felt walking hand in hand with a policeman, because I thought everybody would assume I was being dragged off to prison. Amazing what four-year-olds can think about. And he took me to the Lost Property Office. And in the back of the Lost Property Office, there were a few sort of camp beds. And there was another little boy who was sitting there sobbing his eyes out. A very kindly lady who gave me something to drink and some biscuits. I had a great time. And I was trying to convince this little boy not to cry, but his parents would come back. And eventually I can remember hearing my father's voice at the counter asking if they'd seen a little boy, and he came in to get me. I knew he'd come. I knew he'd find me. But even when I became an adult, he used to refer to me as being his piece of lost property. And it's amazing how images, how experiences, for good or for bad, can stick with you. Now, the one I mention is not particularly harmful or unpleasant. I've never particularly worried about it. I've never been afraid of being lost, for that matter. But nonetheless, I remember it very clearly. But I suggest to you that there are many of us who become bruised reeds because of things that we can't forget,
whether they're experiences or things that have happened to us, or words that people have said, often things that we have absolutely no control over. And very much like that strong reed that's been built to stand straight and firm, once it's damaged, the damage is done. And something changes forever inside. And there are many people who've experienced bits of them dying inside because they've gone through such an awful experience. And I can only imagine the lady that we read about in Luke's Gospel was one of those people. She had had this awful condition for 12 years. Whether it was endometriosis, whether it was fibroids, there were all manner of medical diagnoses that could explain her condition. Whatever it was, she had paid literally such a price for it. She had paid money to doctors and had failed. She was living with this difficult condition that would sap her energy and her strength. But more than that, in the society in which she lived, she was an outcast. Because she was ritually unclean. She wouldn't be able to touch her husband. She wouldn't be able to touch her children. She was unable to prepare food. If she touched anyone or somebody touched what she had touched, they would become ritually unclean as well. And so that had big repercussions if you were going to worship and do all manner of things. If you were ritually unclean, you had to have several days outside of that. So she would have withdrawn from her family and friends to protect them and would have lived very much on the edge of the people she loved most. And she'd endured that for 12 years. I can only imagine how her spirit must have been crushed. How physically, emotionally, spiritually, she would have felt utterly worthless. And yet when she heard that Jesus was going to be in town, you can imagine her almost shrinking from the other people in the crowd because she was trying not to touch them until she finally reached Jesus and she put out her hand. Imagine her consternation, her surprise, her shock, her horror when Jesus turned around and said, "Who touched me?" And the disciples, of course, thought that's a stupid thing to ask. There's loads of people here. Everybody's touching you. No, somebody touched me for a reason, with a purpose. Who touched me? And suddenly she's exposed. In all her frailty and vulnerability, maybe there were lots of people who didn't know what she had been enduring, and she was forced to speak it out loud. And then Jesus took hold of her and told her that she would be healed from that instant on. Can you imagine the relief, the joy, the peace that she would have experienced, being able to run home and suddenly hug everybody and say, "You don't have to worry about me anymore. Jesus has healed me." Isaiah prophesied that Jesus would not break a bruised reed. Instead, he repairs, he heals, he restores. That's what he does. And I'm absolutely certain that there are some of us here this morning who, maybe not identifying with the experience of the lady in Luke's Gospel, can nonetheless identify with this concept of being a bruised reed, that they have been broken. Perhaps through no fault of their own, but broken nonetheless. And it seems to me that there are an awful lot of people in this world who not only have to suffer the stigma of who they are and what they have experienced, but then society blames them for having suffered it in the first place. Now, recently, for other reasons, don't worry about it, I've been doing a real lot of reading about the history of deaf people and how they're portrayed in literature. And one thing which strikes me is that deaf people have not only been stigmatized for being deaf, they've been accused of being deaf. It's your fault that you can't hear. And they are penalized again and again. And there are many people who feel that. As this lady would have done, not only was it bad enough to suffer from the condition, the law was penalizing her, the religious law. It wasn't her fault. Why should she suffer anymore? But nonetheless, it did. And Jesus promises to break through all of that. On Friday evening, my cousin had come down from York, and we went to a Japanese embassy. And the reason we went is because every summer, the Japanese embassy has what they call a reception of peace and reconciliation. And it started when there were still Far East prisoners of war alive. Well, they're all dead now. Her father was one. He was in the RAF. He spent 4 years as a guest of the Japanese. And he was tortured and he was beaten and he was starved, like so many. But he survived. And he felt guilty about surviving. Well, there were 400,000 Japanese prisoners of war. And you can imagine the experiences that many of them endured. Almost to the end of his life, he couldn't shake this. You can imagine, having gone through such an experience, how could he forget it? And a series of events took place, which I won't go into detail now, so that he was able to take his wife, my aunt, back to Singapore, where he'd been imprisoned, and show her the prison, which is now a museum, and say, "This is where I was taken. This is where this all happened." He had never been able to speak to anybody about it before. And so, yes, there are lots of people who, for one reason or another, find themselves in a situation where they are marginalized, where they're vulnerable, where they're lost, and they identify with being a bruised reed. So many. And yet Jesus promises he won't break one. The church I mentioned earlier on, where the young lady used to dance, there was another young lady in the church, and she had got engaged to be married. And as it was getting closer towards the wedding date, they came round to see my wife, and I and her fiancé said, "Look, we've got a terrible problem. Alison," for that was her name, "Alison will suddenly blank out, and she will attack me. It might be in the street. It even happened once on a railway station platform. It's as if something suddenly changes. She doesn't know who she is, and she physically attacks me, and she has no recollection afterwards of what had happened." So we thought about all the different possibilities. We ended up praying together. And during that time, God gave me a picture of a little girl on a swing, going back and forth, back and forth. And as I watched the little girl on the swing, I had this incredible pain inside. It was the pain of total loneliness, of rejection. So I said to Alison, "Look, I think God's given me a picture. What does this mean?" And she said, "Oh, I remember that swing." She said, "I lived in the countryside and my mother was psychiatrically ill. And often I would walk home from the village school and I didn't know whether my parents would be home because my father would have had to have taken her off to the psychiatric hospital again. So I was on my own and I used to go in the garden because I hadn't got a key to get into the house. And I used to sit on that swing by myself, hour after hour, swinging, waiting until somebody came home." And she said, "I felt completely abandoned, so lonely, so rejected." And she said, "Well, maybe because I'm getting close to the wedding, I'm afraid my fiancé is going to abandon me. I'm afraid he's going to reject me. And that's why I'm having these absences and I'm attacking him." And we prayed it through and she never had another episode. That experience, not her fault, had lived with her all that time and was damaging her life. She was a bruised reed, but when Jesus intervened, she became straight and she became strong again. And I would encourage any of us that if we feel that in some way our lives have been damaged or have been broken, that we come to God and we say, allow me to receive this healing. Take the power of those words that were spoken into my life away. Take away the force of this experience that I couldn't help, the damage that was caused, this memory that won't let go, and let me live again. Sometimes I believe, even after we've been healed, God leaves us with a little bit of a mark as a reminder of what he's done. What do I mean by that? Well, do you remember in the Old Testament, there's this rather strange episode where Jacob wrestles with the angel of the Lord by the brook Jabbok. It's a weird anecdote. Well, I'm no Hebrew scholar, but I'm told that if you look at the original Hebrew, where it describes the angel of the Lord, it actually refers to God himself. So it wasn't the angel, it was Jesus. Jesus appearing in the Old Testament. Well, there are lots of times when Jesus appeared in the Old Testament, and that's another matter. It was Jesus himself who wrestled with Jacob. And the writer says that the wrestling match came to an end when the angel put out the hip joint of Jacob. And he had to stop because he lost. But the writer goes on to say, ever afterwards, Jacob walked with a limp. In other words, he would never forget his encounter with God. He had a reminder, literally, that he lived with every day. And I think sometimes God does remind us of what's happened in the past and how he has brought healing. Now, one of my favourite pastimes is I spend a lot of time in the gym. So every weekday morning, between about 6:30 in the morning and 8:00, I'm weight training in our local gym. There's a whole group of us, and we all know each other well. In fact, I've got a prayer partner in it now. And we come together, and we train together, and we know each other well. But my mentor actually is not one of those guys. We met through a mutual friend some years ago, a guy called Rodney, anyway. He won't mind me telling you this because he's actually written a book with all of this in, so it's freely available. It's on the internet as well. And Rodney lives in central London at the moment, and he's an amazing guy for lots of reasons. And he's always sending me tips and videos and saying, train this way and do this and do that. Why? Well, I'll explain why. Rodney came from a very, very difficult background. I don't know a great deal about it. All I know is that it was totally chaotic, and the only member of his family that he has any contact with now is his younger brother. By his own admission, he said at the age of 12, he dropped out of school. By the age of 14, he was part of a gang. By the age of 17, he was in prison for attempted murder. Now you imagine that sort of background. Suddenly he found himself in prison at the age of 17. Banged up for most of each day. He was desperate to get out of the cell. So he heard from some of the other inmates, well, if you go to the gym, you get extra time. So he thought, great, I'll sign up, I'll go to the gym. Never been in a gym before, never played sports. Nothing. He went into the gym, looked at all his equipment, he thought, I haven't got the first clue what to do. So he just stood at the back and watched. And then over a period of time, he started to copy what they were doing. After a few weeks of this, the man who ran the gym, who wasn't a prison warden, he came from outside, came up to Rodney, and he said, you know, there's something different about you. You have actually got some quite natural talent. He said, if you let me, I can train you to a high standard. To which Rodney's reply was, doesn't mean I get more time out of myself. And he said, yes. He said, you can train me what you like. He didn't even know what he was offering to train him. Well, it was something called powerlifting. Within a year, the man who ran the gym said to Rodney, you are now good enough to compete in the national championships. But he said, we have a problem. You're in prison. And no prisoner has ever competed in a national championship, ever. So he said, I've got to convince the governor, to convince the Home Office, to let you out of the championships. And they did. He was the first person to be given that dispensation. So he used to arrive at championship competitions with his coach and an entourage of six prison wardens. And the other competitors used to pull his leg about him and say, oh, look, you're already so famous. You've got this entourage you have to travel with. And he won. And he became British national champion. He became European national champion. He became ranked number two in the world for 2 years in succession. When he was let out of prison, well, this was all he knew. So he managed to go and buy a gym. Sold it 2 years later at a vast profit. Bought a business, sold that at a vast profit. Do you remember gladiators on television? Who do you think trained the gladiators? It was Rodney. So he built up quite a reputation for himself until he started getting bored with it, and he decided to do something else, and he became a currency trader. And that's what he does today. He's still training hard, but he's a currency trader. And if you talk to Rodney about his experiences, he will always come back to the same point. If it were not for the man in charge of the gym seeing something in me that I didn't know myself, I wouldn't be here now. And he said every one of the members of the gang that I used to run with were dead in their 20s. I'm the only one who survived. So he said, I have that man to thank for absolutely everything. Because of his intervention, he totally changed my life. An incredible story. A wonderful thing to have happened. But this is what God does with us. This is what he offers. He offers this transformation that allows us to change and to grow even from the most unlikely set of circumstances and origins, so that we turn into the person that he always intended us to be. So I would encourage all of us this morning to think about this, to think about the bruised reed. We don't have to stay bruised forever. We don't have to be broken. We can be healed and we can be restored because of who Jesus is. Let's pray for a moment. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the testimony of the lady in Luke. We thank you for the prophecy of Isaiah. We thank you for all those who have known what it is to suffer and to be rejected, and then to find acceptance and relationship with you. Lord, we ask that this morning you would touch our hearts, our minds, our memories, and our lives. Allow us to rid ourselves of those things that keep us in a broken state. And instead, allow us, Lord, to stand firm, to stand strong, and to look up to you, glorying in who you are and what you have done. And this we ask in Jesus' name.